I would like to reserve 3 minutes for
3 minutes, yes, ma'am.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Kelly King, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Braulio Castillo. We are asking this court to reverse the trial court's findings with regards to the finding of abuse and neglect, as well as the termination of Mr. Castillo's parental rights with regards to his 4 minor children. It bears noting in this case, there's a lengthy history and a lengthy record, and I would ask the court to take judicial notice of the fact that this has a parallel appeal also pending before this court in a criminal matter that is inextricably intertwined with his civil case. Both of Mr. Castillo's appeals are currently pending. With regards to the criminal appeal, this court has granted 8 assignments of errors for merit argument with regards to the criminal case, and that is currently pending.
That doesn't alter the finality of the circuit court's judgment, though, does it?
Not of the circuit court judgment. Certainly, there is no final conviction by definition from the Supreme Court. Under Griffith v. Kentucky, there's no final conviction in the criminal matter.
No, but in terms of the application of the statute, which says that the residual rights. This I'm looking at 283E little double I, which says that basically parental rights can be terminated if the parent has been convicted of an offense under the laws of the Commonwealth that constitutes murder, voluntary manslaughter, or a felony attempt if the victim of the offense was the other parent of the child, which is clearly arguably the case here. The question is whether there's clear and convincing evidence upon which the circuit court could rely in the domestic case, which they did, obviously. And so the fact that was subsequently appealed, I'm not sure how that impacts on the finality of, obviously if it gets set aside on appeal, that may be time to revisit all this or something, but it seems to me from the standpoint of whether the trial court erred, at the time this judgment was entered, there was no appeal pending, correct?
That is correct. However, and this is essentially getting to the MG versus Albemarle case out of this court, where the court determined this particular issue related under 283 subsection E little 3, pertaining to conviction, but that had to do with serious sexual assault as opposed to, in this case, murder. And in that case, this court held that a conviction does not need to be final in the sense of a final conviction as defined by the Supreme Court, but it needs to be conviction in the sense of there's been a final order of the trial court.
Let's pause for a minute, if you can pause the time. Are you the guardian ad litem?
Yes, Your Honor.
No, you're fine. Come on in. We welcome you. We appreciate the guardian ad litem being present at any of these. Thank you. I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
In this particular case, however, what distinguishes it, and this brings me to my assignment of error number 4, which I think is one of the more interesting points in this case, is the fact that at the time that this trial commenced, there was no final order in the criminal matter. That case was still pending at the time that the court and the department...
Didn't the court, at the request of your client, hold the matter open until there was a final order in the criminal case?
That was at the request of the department over the objection of Mr. Castillo. And that's the interesting point.
Although Mr. Castillo had made a similar request initially that had been denied.
That's correct. And that's what perhaps is so interesting here is the fact that...
It's this point that gave me some hesitation. Given that the discussion we've just had on 16.12.83E II, are you suggesting that we should not make a ruling in this case until the criminal appeal is done? That's like holding the record open, I suppose.
I would certainly, I understand the current state of the law by which this court needs to follow. Certainly, that would be a request I would make if there would be a stay with regards to this matter, precisely because of this issue that's before the court now. Mr. Castillo would have no recourse should his criminal case be overturned and should the termination determined to be final. And the termination in this case, as we all are well aware, is essentially based on the criminal case.
Well, wasn't it also, I mean, there was E, but there were also grounds filed under B and C, isn't that right?
The ultimate holding of the trial court was found under 283B and 283E.
Okay.
There was
so
not
B,
a finding made under C.
Okay, so B would not necessarily or mandatorily be impacted by the effect of the criminal conviction, is that correct?
That's correct, although it's still intertwined with the court's holding,
sure.
which essentially found that because he caused Mrs. Castillo's absence, that's part of the ruling under subsection B as well, and the substantial harm or risk of substantial harm to the children was still based on the same acts as the criminal conviction.
Well, I sort of want to hear from your opponents on this point, but I think Judge Huff raises a good point. It seems we're supposed to decide these on the narrowest and best basis, I guess, in this case. And there are, as Judge O'Brien has just pointed out, the trial judge found two alternative grounds to terminate parental rights, but it seems arguably the more straightforward of the two is the criminal conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
And if that criminal conviction is altered by this course through the appellate, or the Supreme Court, I guess, through the appellate process, then that may make a difference in terms of whether we even need to address the remaining assignment of error. So, you know, do I understand, at least as far as your position, legal position is concerned, your preference would be for us to basically address the matter after the criminal convictions are resolved, at least in this court?
Certainly, that would absolutely be our preference, and that would solve the current dilemma and the current posture of the case law, by which he would have no other recourse. Should that criminal conviction be overturned and remanded or reversed for a new trial, given the eight errors that are before the court.
Has the criminal conviction been set for argument yet?
So the eight errors were assigned for merit. There was a writ panel requested, a three-judge panel requested for the remaining errors, which were...
You know which errors, which assignments of error were actually granted? We could look it up, I suppose, but it's easier just to ask you if you know.
I do. There were eight of them. There was severance, so the motion to sever, that was not granted.
Sufficiency has not been granted?
There was not one on sufficiency. Severance, confrontation clause, cadaver dog, attorney-client privilege. Now I'm failing at the... But there were a number of large... constitutional issues and on constitutional grounds that were granted the merits of. The argument has not been set and the remaining...
Well, I mean, hypothetically, that it seems to me, let's assume that the criminal appeal results in a remand for a new trial. As far as you're concerned, would there be anything to prohibit us from proceeding to address the merits of the other issue rather than holding this thing pending an entire new trial and a new appeal if necessary?
Given that they are inextricably intertwined and given the court's ruling with regards to its finding that he was responsible for the death of his wife, and given that that is intertwined in the court's ruling under subsection B, 283B, and that was partly based on the fact that this was the same trial judge and he heard the criminal matter and he determined that a jury had found him guilty, I don't see any way to parse out either of those or to find that one
was
appropriate.
Well, certainly a court could judicially notice its own records, and so whether he was the trial judge or not, in the abstract at least, there'd be absolutely nothing wrong with him noting the status of a related criminal case.
Oh, certainly. However, if that case got remanded and if there were error, that would affect, I believe, his ruling both under B and E. So I would object or say that it would be improper for the court to rule, for this court to make a determination as to one without the other if the criminal case was remanded. I think the basis of the court's ruling entirely was based on the criminal act. There were no other allegations, essentially, with regards to the children themselves. But to come back to the motion to hold open and Judge Huff's point, Mr. Castillo did pre-trial, a timely motion pre-trial, bring to the trial court's attention that the issue was not ripe for hearing with regards to termination under subsection E, and said there's been no final order, there's been a jury verdict, there have not been post-trial motions heard or argued, and there's been no sentencing by the court, and there's been no final order by the trial court.
Well, I think where I'm going with all this is let's assume that the case is hypothetically remanded based on a confrontation clause violation. That confrontation, Sixth Amendment, doesn't apply in a civil proceeding. So that fact would not necessarily impact on our ability to resolve the merits of this case, based on any sort of Sixth Amendment application.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I believe that's correct. However, given the volume and the magnitude of the errors, if it is reversed, I think there could be a very different outcome at a new criminal trial, which would impact the court's analysis of all of these, both under the abuse and neglect statute under 228 as well as 283. And that's the problem with this case, is it's all intertwined, and there's no way to parse out. There's no way to say, well, there was other evidence that the court could have found a basis for abuse and neglect. If we look at the bases by which the court found, for example, abuse and neglect under 228 subsection 1, was substantial risk of mental impairment of mental functioning. That related straight back to his belief that he was responsible for the murder. If we look under 228.5, unreasonable absence of parental care or guardianship. And I submit on my brief with regards to that. I don't want to get too bogged down in the abuse and neglect. I understand that's an abuse of discretion, and that's very fact-specific, which is difficult for this court to see or override the trial court's findings on that. But, for example, under 228.5, the court found that he was incarcerated, and that was an unreasonable absence, and the children were left without parental care or guardianship, and that, in fact, was not the evidence presented in the case. The children were removed on an emergency basis on March 20th, 2014, and placed into the foster care system. They were already in the foster care system at the time at which Mr. Castillo was later placed in custody, subsequently released onto bond. They were in custody the whole time through the Department of Family Services. So I would submit the evidence does not support at any time that there was an absence of parental care or guardianship, as is required under that. So certainly the court could make separate analyses, specifically fact-based, that do not rely solely on the criminal conviction. However, it's difficult to parse out. I would submit that there is an abuse of discretion when there has been no evidence to substantiate that, for in that scenario, that there was a lack of parental care or guardianship when there was. That's essentially saying that when the kids are in foster care, if a parent is later incarcerated, that becomes a neglect situation, and that's simply not the case. It's designed for situations where the children are left without anybody, and then foster care has to swoop in and take them and remove them, and that could be considered neglect, and that's what the case law supports. With regards to the case law under substantial risk of mental impairment or mental functions, as this court is well aware, that's primarily designed at physical abuse of children, physical neglect of children, scenarios where there's a failure to thrive, where there's not nutrition, where they're not receiving medical care, where they're being physically abused, emotionally abused. The cases are very different than the case before this court. That evidence is completely absent in this case. The trial court kept coming back to the criminal case. And that is the isolated incident by which it then bases all of its rulings. And with regards to the motion to hold open the evidence, I say that it matters not that Mr. Castillo timely filed a motion pretrial. It's important to note that the trial court determined there not to be good cause to grant a continuance or to stay the proceedings of that matter.
A trial court can change its mind. It may not be a pretty sight, but could change its mind and did here. I mean, does that make it error?
I would submit yes, if a court has already made a determination that there's not good cause to hold it open or to continue the matter. And the court in this case also made a ruling on the record that to start and stop and recommence a trial would not be in the best interest of the children. So you have scenarios where it's easy to fall back on the best interest standard. Here, the court had previously made a ruling on the record that would not be in their best interest. Court had made that ruling and had made that there was no good cause shown, and nothing changed with regards to that. It's not that additional evidence came to light and the court changed its mind. Court had made these rulings on the record. Mr. Castillo is allowed to rely on those rulings reasonably, and then the court, for no apparent reason, mid-trial, then grants the motion to hold open the evidence. And the key and important harmful error to that is the fact that the evidence is then held open for an additional 6 months, almost 6 months.
That's what you're asking us to do, though, right?
It would be ideal if that had been done at the time. It would be ideal if it could be done now. I don't know that the court would feel the state of the case law supports that. However, if the court were willing to consider that, that would absolutely be our request.
I remind you, you're well into your rebuttal time. I know there are many issues here.
Thank you.
Thanks. Ms. Glennie.
Thank you. May it please the court. Sandra Glennie on behalf of the Department of Family Services in Loudoun County. In this particular case, we had a tension, and I would ask the court to consider that tension with regard to any request to keep this case open. The tension in this case was the need to reach these children to reach permanency and Mr. Castillo's criminal case. And we were deferring the court and the department to Mr. Mr. Castillo's right to plead the Fifth Amendment in that criminal case, and the fact that he was not going to be able to fully defend in our case until such time as the criminal case concluded in the guilt phase, at least. And so that was what was driving and the procedural posture of this case. And so the children did not reach, the dispositional hearing did not reach finality until we got way into 2017 for a ruling.
So what would your position be on our withholding an opinion until after the criminal appeals are completed? I mean, it sounds to me like it would run into that same issue. The children are held in limbo.
Absolutely, and I think the M.G. Albemarle case does argue against it. In that case, this court found that the final order of the circuit court is a final order for that establishes conviction. And it's because of that tension in the code where we have this statutory framework the legislature has said, these children need to reach permanency within a reasonable time, and 1 year under C2. So we are looking at a situation here where because Mr. Castillo had continued his criminal case for 2 years, by the time we reached the dispositional hearing in the circuit court, at that point in time, the children had been in care for 2.5 years.
So I understand your position being you oppose any delay.
I do. Okay. I do oppose that, Your Honor. I do oppose any delay, and I believe that Mr. Castillo received, I would contend he received more than fair treatment through the circuit court process and through the juvenile court process. The timeline in this case is very important, and it's what kind of drives, if you will, some of the allegations that you get of error in the procedures in this case. The court in the juvenile case went to preliminary removal hearing and adjudication on April 4th of 2014. Mr. Castillo was incarcerated at that time. Mr. Castillo's children had not been in foster care prior to a few days before that. There was a safety plan that was in place. They were removed 5 days prior to April 4th, and then we had our 5-day hearing with an adjudication. He was incarcerated at that time. And then at that point, the court set the dispositional hearing for June 5th of 2014. Appeal was noted of the dispositional orders to the circuit court. But of course, as Your Honors know, the matter continues in the juvenile court. And in the juvenile court, up and until August of 2015, the Department of Family Services filed foster care plans with return home goals. There was no prejudging of this case. There was a return home goal until August of 2015, at which time the department filed for adoption. And at that point, the juvenile court set the matter, the second permanency planning hearing, over to June of 2016. In deference, again, to Mr. Castillo and his constitutional right to plead the Fifth.
When was the jury conviction?
The jury conviction came down on June the 17th, I believe, around mid-June
of
2016.
16.
And we filed our termination of parental rights petition, our amended termination of parental rights petition, on June 22nd of 2016. So after the jury verdict came down, Mr. Castillo had taken the stand in the criminal case and testified, thus waiving his Fifth Amendment rights. That was the point at which the Department of Family Services filed the termination of parental rights on the four grounds, B, C, 2, E, 2, and E, 4.
The goal had already changed, though, a year before to adoption.
No, because the judge deferred on that and did not make a ruling. So the second permanency planning, Your Honor, was set over to June of 2016. It was then that the court approved that goal of adoption and then also entered orders of termination of parental rights for the children. So at that point, we then proceeded to the circuit court hearing. And the circuit court hearing on the dispositional hearing, which again had not been held, was set for September of 2016. It was at that point when the termination of parental rights case went up that we're in something of a box. The termination of parental rights case is to be heard within 90 days, not mandatory, directory. But we haven't had the dispositional hearing yet because of the deference to Mr. Castillo. So in order to abide by the 90 days, we would have had to be heard within September, that September time frame. Therefore, the Department of Family Services filed a motion to combine this matter. And that is why you have the allegations that both we violated the 90 days, and yet we combined, and so we are in this situation at that point. So I suggest to the court that this was the best way to handle it in deference to Mr. Castillo, but also in recognition of the rights of the children to reach permanency. We have to balance that tension in this case. And so at that point, we then moved forward with the hearing in September, with the anticipation that the sentencing phase would conclude soon. It did not conclude, all good intentions. It did not conclude until December, and December 30th of 2016, you had the final sentencing order. So as the department is preparing to close its case, we made the motion to hold the case open. What I would tell the court is neither the court nor the department nor Mr. Castillo would have been aware at that time what that final order would be. Again, it was in deference to Mr. Castillo that the case is held open so that we might determine whether there was any judgment, notwithstanding the verdict or any other.
But how do you justify the court granting your motion to hold the record open when they've already done the reverse with reasons stated?
Well, I justify it this way, Your Honor, because early in the case, the motions for continuance that were filed by the department were filed on the basis of the criminal case continuing, in deference to Mr. Castillo. The motion that was made by Mr. Castillo came after the criminal case in August of 2016, as we're getting ready to proceed to trial in September of 2016. The guilt phase has concluded. He has waived his Fifth Amendment right. We're in a different posture. So I submit to the court, it was not abuse of discretion for the court to recognize that presumption of innocence for Mr. Castillo. And I would suggest that Appendix at 5 is where the judge captures that ruling and why he made that decision. And he says this is an unusual set of circumstances. Mr. Castillo has a presumption of innocence. We are looking at trying to not stop and start, and we believe that this criminal case needs to conclude so that we can have full resolution of the Department of Family Services case. So when we came to the hearing in September, October, November, we're finishing, the court at that point in time, in recognition of the need to make sure that all the evidence is in, and this is again in the discretion of the judge, to make sure all the evidence is in, he holds it open in order to admit the final sentencing. So I think there is a different procedural posture there where the court had reasons early on, but then the reasons are gone by the time we get to August of 2016. So, Your Honor, I would submit that this case there is a great deal of evidence in this case. It was overwhelming in this case. There was a jury verdict beyond a reasonable doubt. The abuse and neglect did not ride simply on the criminal case. In 283B, what the judge said is there was domestic violence in the home, which he said was not severe enough, but he found abuse and neglect early on. There was domestic violence in the home, and there was no available caregiver. And so there were some other facts to support the abuse and neglect. Now, when he got to 283B, he said, I have a jury verdict. And the 283B does not require a conviction. It requires that there be severe abuse and neglect. And what the judge said is, I have a jury verdict beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Castillo entered the home. He murdered the mother of the children. It was a violent act. He left the children in the home with the dead body of the mother, and he violated a protective order. He found that was sufficient.
Should we be giving any weight to the fact that some of the children testified against Mr. Castillo at his criminal trial?
Yes.
Does that affect the placement of the children, the decision that was made here?
Yes. That very much goes to, Your Honors, the question about relative placement. And I know that has also been raised. The relatives that came in were all, they stated 100% in favor of Mr. Castillo, believed him to be innocent. But that was not everything. And I've laid out in detail in the brief the other considerations that the department made in terms of their financial situation, in terms of the children's concerns, and in terms of other things going on, whether it was mental health issues and the like. So there were other issues that the department found. When the judge came to his ruling, he made the ruling based upon what was in front of him under Hawthorne. He said, I have enough evidence in front of me under Hawthorne that I can make the decision. The only thing the statute requires is that he give consideration. It does not require that the judge go into great detail as to what the department did in terms of its investigation. Only that the judge give consideration, which he did. And he said, based on what I have in front of me, a separate investigation is not required, and I have enough information to know that these are not suitable. But absolutely, in terms of their failure to support the children in view, their view, they had testified for the prosecution. So, yes. Your Honors, have any other questions? I am happy to address them. I would ask the court to sustain the finding, both under B and E2. If E2 is not, if the court does not feel that that is ripe at this point in time in that sense, B is certainly fully supported in this case. Thank you.
Let me inquire of Mr. Morgan.
Yes, sir.
We got started a little earlier. You were not late. You were given notice for 1 o'clock. And I think we'd gotten started a little before 1. But was there, and we had had a discussion before you arrived about whether you were planning on making any separate statements. Were you?
I fully support the county's arguments and statements that they've made. I would reiterate with the court that what Ms. Glennie had told the court about the timeline of events, I think, is extremely important with regard to the procedures and the reasons why certain decisions were made, including that appendix number 5, where Judge Sienkiewicz specifically lays out his reasoning for the continuances. With regard to the 283B, I also think that there's plenty of independent evidence aside from that criminal conviction alone that would merit the finding. And then finally, Judge Huff, I think you asked a very good question about the placement. And while a court only has to consider relative placement, certainly the fact that some of these children did, in fact, take the stand, and there's evidence in the record regarding what psychological impact that would have on a potential caretaker. And that, I think, does play some role in this. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. All right, on to rebuttal.
Thank you. Your Honor, to address a few points, the department tries to make this out to be that they're deferring to Mr. Castillo's rights, when the reality of the situation was they could not proceed, and they knew full well they would not be able to prove their case on the pleadings without the criminal case having been finalized. And that's the fact of the matter. It wasn't a deference to him. It was that they didn't have other information by which the court could base these abuse and neglect findings or termination findings.
But there was evidence of prior domestic violence?
There was, and this bleeds into one of my assignment of errors with regards to the prior testimony in a protective order hearing that was presented. The court did make a finding under the abuse and neglect statute under subsection 1 that the domestic allegations of domestic abuse that had happened 4 years prior were sufficient to make a finding under that abuse and neglect standard, although we obviously take exception to that. Given the particular nature of that, that there was substantial risk of harm, you're talking about a scenario that was 4 years prior, there were no intervening acts, CPS did not get involved, police declined to prosecute, and there was no involvement of Department of Family Services. So you have a situation where the court is saying there was substantial risk of harm. However, there was no intervention, and there was no harm. And this is a scenario where there is very little, if any, evidence presented by the department that there was any actual harm, any risk of harm to these children. I described that in my reply brief. However, I would submit that I don't think that meets the findings under abuse and neglect, and that was not, the court made clear, one of his findings under the termination statute. The court specifically said under termination that I am not considering any prior domestic abuse or allegations of such from 4 years prior to find termination under subsection B. Mm-hmm. And I'd ask the court to consider that the presumption in this case is in favor of maintaining parental relationships, and that cannot be overlooked by talking about timelines in this particular case and how it comes before the court. This court has held in Wright v. Alexandria, when a state infringes upon a parent's constitutional rights to the companionship of his child in order to protect a child from abuse and neglect, it must satisfy the mandates of procedural due process. And here we have the violation under 296D in the 90 days. And this sounds a little bit like game playing when you hear the department say it now, that we objected to a continuous at the time because we had to get the 90 days in. And then once we got into trial, we didn't hear a hearing on the merits of the case. Then I asked for the continuance. And further, I would just note that there were no separate proceedings. That's another violation that this court has held multiple times as a violation of procedural due process.
Although a finding under E II would not fall to that argument.
Separate proceedings is actually under 16.1.283A. So it applies to all below that a termination proceeding of any nature under B or E has to be a separate proceeding from an abuse and neglect adjudication. So I submit that applies to both B and E, okay. And it's held at the top of the statute. So that is a requirement that this court has already held is a violation of Mr. Castillo's due process rights. And with regards to relative placement, these relatives, these blood relatives who had been integral part of these children's lives, were strategically removed, systematically removed from the kids' lives because all of the relatives believed in his innocence. And that includes Mrs. Castillo's mother. The maternal grandmother was also essentially removed from their lives because of a presumption of innocence in their belief. And I would ask that was held against him, that there was not proper consideration of relative placement or an investigation of that. It should not just be perfunctory. It has to be reasonable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will step down and greet counsel, and then that concludes the docket for the day. Thank you.